down, made a bound, grazed the case of gunpowder. Horror! We shall be blown to atoms! No. The dazzling disc retreated, approached Hans, who stared calmly at it, and then my uncle, who crouched on his knees to avoid it, then myself, pale and shuddering at the glare and the glow. It gyrated close to my foot, which I was powerless to withdraw. An odor of nitrous gas filled the air. It attacked the throat and lungs. We were all but suffocated. What can it be that hinders me from moving my foot? It feels as if riveted to the raft. I have it. The contact of this electric body has magnetized all the iron on board. Our tools, our firearms were stirred, clicking as they touched each other. The nails of my boots had forcibly adhered to a plate of iron sunk in the timber. I cannot stir my foot. At length, by a violent effort, I succeed in tearing it away, just as the ball was preparing to strike me in its next gyration, if... Oh! What intensity of light! The ball bursts! We are covered with jets of flame! Then all was dark. I had just time to discern my uncle stretched on the raft, Hans motionless at the tiller, and spitting fire under the influence of the electricity which pervaded his body. Again I exclaim, "Where are we going?" Tuesday, August the 25th. I have just recovered from a prolonged swoon. The lightnings are let loose in the atmosphere like a brood of serpents. Are we still at sea? Yes, driving on with incredible swiftness. We have passed under England, under the British Channel, under France, perhaps under all Europe. A new sound greets our ears. Surely the roar of breakers? But in that case... Chapter 37. Here ends what I call my journal on board, which fortunately has been saved from the wreck. I take up my narrative as before. What happened after the raft struck on the rocks, I can scarcely tell. I felt that I was thrown among the breakers, and if I escaped death, if my body was not mangled by the pointed rocks, it was the strong arm of Hans that plucked me from the waters. The courageous Icelander carried me beyond the reach of the waves, and laid me on a burning, sandy shore, where I found myself side by side with my uncle. Then he returned to the rocks, where the angry sea was dashing, in order to try and save some waifs from the wreck. I could not speak. I was worn out with excitement and fatigue. It was more than an hour before I recovered my faculties. Even at this time a deluge of rain was falling, but with that accumulated force that betokens the end of the storm. Some rocks piled on others afforded us shelter from the torrent. Hans prepared some food, which I could not touch, and then, exhausted by our 3 nights' watch, we fell into a troubled sleep. Next day, the weather was glorious. Sky and sea united in soft repose. All trace of the tempest was dissipated. Such was the joyful news with which the professor greeted me on awaking. His gaiety jarred on my nerves. "Well, my lad," said he, "I hope you slept well." He spoke as if we were at home in the Königstrasse, and that I had just come down to breakfast on my wedding morning with poor Gräuben. Alas! If the storm has only impelled the raft to the eastward, we should have passed under Germany, under my beloved town of Hamburg, perhaps under the very street where dwells all that is dearest to me in the world. Then there would only have been 120 miles between us, but 120 vertical miles through a granite wall, and in reality we had more than 3,000 miles to travel. All these melancholy thoughts flashed through my mind, before I replied to my uncle's question. "Well," said he, "I asked you how you slept." "Very well," said I. "I am knocked up, but that is nothing. Nothing at all. Merely a little fatigue." "You seem in great spirits this morning, uncle," said I. "Delighted, my lad. Delighted. We have arrived." "At the end of our expedition?" "No, but at the end of the weary sea. We shall now resume our land journey, and this time we shall penetrate into the bowels of the earth."
"But, uncle, may I ask you a question?"
"You may, Axel."
"How are we to get back?"
"Get back? Is your mind on getting back before we've even arrived at our journey's end?" "No, I merely wanted to know how it is to be accomplished." "The simplest thing in the world. Once arrived at the center of the spheroid, we shall discover a new route, whereby to regain the surface, or else we shall return, in a commonplace manner, by the same road by which we came. It will not be closed behind us, that is one comfort."
"But in that case, the raft must be made tight."
"Of course."
"But have we provision for all this travelling?"
"We have. Hans is a right clever fellow, and I'm sure he has saved the greatest part of our cargo. However, come, let us see."
We left the windy grotto. I had a hope, which was almost a fear. It seemed to me impossible that anything on board the raft could have survived that terrible landing. I was wrong. When I reached the beach, Hans was in the midst of a mass of objects, arranged in order. My uncle pressed his hand with the liveliest gratitude. This man, whose superhuman devotion is probably without a parallel, had toiled while we slept, and had saved all that was most precious to us, at the risk of his own life. Not that we had not serious losses. Our firearms, for example, but those we could do without. The powder was uninjured, having missed explosion during the storm.
"Well," exclaimed the professor, "as the guns are gone, we cannot be expected to go hunting. That is something."
"That is all very well," said I, "but what of our instruments?"
"Here is the manometer, the most useful of all, and for which I would have given all the rest. Having that, I can calculate our depth, and ascertain when we are at the center. Without it, we should run the risk of coming out at the antipodes."
His joking manner appeared to me ferocious.
"And the compass?" said I. "Here it is, on the rock, quite unharmed, and the chronometer and thermometer. Oh, the hunter is an invaluable fellow."
This could not be gainsaid. Not one of our instruments was missing. As to tools and implements, I saw scattered on the sand ladders, ropes, pickaxes, mattocks, etc. There only remained the victualling question.
"And the provisions?" said I. "Aye, let me see the provisions," said my uncle.
The cases which contained them were lying in a row on the strand, in a perfect state of preservation. The sea had spared them for the most part, and taking everything together, biscuit, salt meat, Geneva, and dried fish, we had sufficient for 4 months.
4 months? Cried the professor. "Why, we have enough to go and come back, and with what is left I will give a grand dinner to my colleagues at the Johanneum."
I ought to have been used to my uncle's eccentricities by this time, but still they never ceased to surprise me.
"Now," said he, "we can replenish our water stores from the granite basins which the storm has filled with rain, so we are in no danger of suffering from thirst. As to the raft, I should recommend Hans to make the best job he can of it, although I do not at all expect to want it again."
"Why not?" said I.
"A fancy of mine, my boy. I do not think we shall come out where we came in."
I looked at the professor with great misgiving. I wondered if he had gone crazed, but he spoke quite collectedly.
"Let us go to breakfast," said he.
I followed him to a high promontory, after he had given directions to the hunter. There, dried meat, biscuit, and tea made up an excellent meal, one of the best I ever made in my life. Fasting, the fresh air, and rest following strong excitement all combined to give me an appetite. During breakfast, I questioned my uncle as to the means of ascertaining where we were at this moment. "That," said I, "seems to me very difficult to calculate."
"Well, yes, to calculate exactly," he answered.
"In fact, it would be impossible, because during the 3 days' storm, I could take no note of the rate or direction of our course, but still by reckoning we can estimate our position approximately." Our last observation was taken at the Giza Island,
at Axel Island, my lad.
Do not decline the honour of giving your name to the first island discovered in the centre of the earth. Be it so. At Axel Island, we had crossed 810 miles of sea, and we were more than 1,800 miles from Iceland.
Just so.
Therefore, starting from that point, let us reckon 4 days of storm, during which our speed was certainly not less than 240 miles in the 24 hours. I think that is about it. So that will be 900 miles to add.
Yes. The Sea of Lidenbrock must be 1,800 miles across.
Do you know, Axel,
it will rival the Mediterranean.
Yes, especially if we have only crossed the breadth,
which is quite possible.
Another curious thing, said I, if our calculations are correct, the Mediterranean must be just above our heads.
Really?
Yes. For we are 2,700 miles from Reykjavik.
That is a good step from here, my lad.
But whether we are under the Mediterranean, rather than under Turkey or under the Atlantic, we cannot decide, unless we are sure that we have not deviated from our course.
Well, it is easy to ascertain by looking at the compass. Let us go and see.
The professor made for the rock on which Hans had arranged the instruments. He was lively, sprightly, rubbed his hands, threw himself into attitudes as he went. He was young again. I followed him, anxious to know if my calculation was correct. Arrived at the rock, my uncle took up the compass, laid it horizontally, and watched the needle, which, after a few oscillations, settled itself into its place. My uncle gazed. He rubbed his eyes and looked again. Then he turned to me with a bewildered air. "What ails you, uncle?" said I. He motioned me to look at the instrument. I uttered an exclamation of astonishment. The needle indicated north, where we had believed the south to be. It turned to the shore, instead of to the open sea. I shook the compass. I examined it. It was in good order. No matter which way I turned it, it persisted in making this unexpected declaration. We could only conclude that during the tempest we had failed to note the change of wind which had brought back the raft to the shore, which my uncle hoped he had left behind him. Chapter 38. No words could depict the succession of emotions which agitated the professor. Bewilderment, incredulity, rage. I never saw a man so discomfited at first, or so enraged afterwards. After all the fatigues of the journey, all the risks we had run, all must be done over again. We had gone back instead of forward. My uncle soon recovered himself.
"What a trick fate has played me. The very elements are against me. The air, the fire, the water conspire to bar my passage. Well, they shall know what my will can accomplish. I will not yield. I will not go back a step, and we shall see whether man or nature will win."
Standing upright on the rock, betraying his irritation by his menacing attitude, Otto Lidenbrock reminded me of Ajax, defying the gods. I thought it time to interpose and put a check on his mad enthusiasm.
"Listen to me, uncle,"
said I in a steadfast voice. There is a limit to human ambition. It is useless to struggle after the impossible. We are badly equipped for a sea voyage. 1,500 miles cannot be done on a raft of unsound timbers with a rag of blanket for a sail and a stick for a mast. And in the face of all the winds of heaven let loose, we have no means of steering. We are the plaything of the storm, and it is the height of madness to attempt the voyage a second time. I set forth all this without interruption for about 10 minutes, but this was owing solely to the inattention of the professor, who did not hear one word of my arguments. "To the raft!" cried he. That was his answer. In vain I entreated him to desist. In vain I stormed. In vain I spent my strength in warring against a will harder than granite. Hans had just completed his repairs of the raft. It was as if this whimsical being had divined my uncle's plans. With some pieces of suture brand, he had strengthened the vessel. A sail was already spread and was flapping in the breeze. The professor gave a few directions to the guide, who immediately put our belongings on board and made everything ready for a start. The air was pretty clear, and the northwest wind held. What could I do? How could I, alone, make head against these two? Impossible, even if Hans had sided with me. But the Icelander seemed to have put away all individual will, and taken a vow of abnegation. I could do nothing with a servant so enslaved to his master. There was nothing for it but to go on. Accordingly, I proceeded to take my usual place on the raft, when my uncle put out his hand to stop me. "We shall not start till tomorrow," said he. I made a gesture of resignation to everything that might be in store for me. "I must omit nothing," said he. "Since fate has thrown me on this part of the coast, I will not leave it without a full examination." This remark will be intelligible when it is understood that we had returned to the north coast, but not to the part from which we had started. Port Gräuben must be more to the west, so that, after all, there was nothing unreasonable in the professor's desire to explore carefully this new region. "Let us go, then, and reconnoitre," said I. And leaving Hans to his occupations, we set out. The space between the beach and the foot of the sea rampart was very extensive. We walked for a good half hour before reaching the rocky wall. Our feet crushed innumerable shells of every form and size, the former homes of extinct species. I also observed countless numbers of carapaces whose diameter often exceeded 15 feet. They had belonged to those giant glyptodons of the Pliocene period, of which the tortoise of our day is but a miniature copy. The ground was also strewn with an immense quantity of rocky debris, a sort of pebbles, rounded by the action of water, and arranged in successive ridgy lines. I judge from this that the sea had at some time occupied this space. On the scattered rocks, now out of their reach, the billows had left evident traces of their passage. This might account in some degree for the existence of an ocean 120 miles below the surface of the earth, but according to my theory, this liquid mass must little by little lose itself in the bowels of the earth, and it is evidently replenished from the waters of the ocean, which find their way through some fissure. Just now, however, the fissure must be closed. Otherwise this cavern, or rather this immense reservoir, would be filled in a very short time. Or perhaps this body of water, struggling against subterranean fires, may be partly vaporized, which would account for the clouds suspended overhead and for the electric disturbances which convulse the interior of the globe. This seemed to me an adequate theory of the phenomena we ourselves had witnessed, for however vast the wonders of nature, They are always referable to physical causes. We were walking on a kind of sedimentary stratum formed by water, like all the strata of that period, so widely distributed over the earth. The professor pored attentively into every chink in the rock. He was convinced that some opening must exist, and it was vital to him to ascertain its depth. We had followed the coast of the Sea of Lidenbrock for a mile, when suddenly the surface exhibited a change. It seemed to have been turned upside down, torn up by the convulsive heaving of the underlying strata. In many places, the extent of the disturbance was attested by deep chasms and corresponding elevations. We made but slow progress over these fragments of granite, mingled here and there with silex, quartz, and alluvial deposits, when we came in sight of a vast plain covered with bones. It was like an immense cemetery, where the generations of 20 centuries mingled their dust. Piles of remains rose behind each other in the distance, undulating like a sea towards the horizon, where they were lost in a soft haze. Here, on an extent of probably 3,000 square miles, was concentrated the whole history of animal life, a history scarcely traceable in the too recent soil of the inhabited world. An insatiable curiosity urged us on. Our feet crushed the remains of prehistoric animals and fossils, whose rare and interesting relics are eagerly competed for by the museums of great cities. The lives of 1,000 Cuvier would not suffice to reconstruct the skeletons that lie in this magnificent assemblage of organic remains. I was speechless with amazement. My uncle threw up his arms towards the impenetrable vault that stood for a sky, his mouth wildly open, his eyes gleaming under his spectacles, his head moving up and down, right and left. His whole demeanour indicated how intense was his astonishment. He found himself in a priceless collection of Leptotherium, Mericotherium, Lophodion, Anoplotherium, Megatherium, Mastodon, Protopithecus, Pterodactyls, all the antediluvian monsters gathered together for his private gratification. Just fancy an enthusiastic bibliomaniac transported in an instant into that Alexandrian library which Omar burnt, and which some miracle had reproduced from its ashes. Such was my Uncle Lidenbrock at this moment. But there came a new phase of astonishment, when hurrying across this organic dust, he seized a skull, and in a voice full of emotion he cried, "Axel! Axel! A human head!" "A human head, Uncle?" said I, equally surprised. "Yes, my lad. Ah! Milne Edwards! Aha! Quatre Fages! Why are you not here with me to behold it?" Chapter 39. To understand why my uncle invoked these illustrious savants, it should be understood that a fact of great importance in paleontology had been announced some time before we left. On March the 28th, 1863, some workmen, under the direction of Monsieur Boucher de Perthes, excavating in the quarries of Moulin-Quignon, near Abbeville, in the department of the Somme, in France, had found a human jawbone 14 feet below the surface. It was the first fossil of that kind ever brought to light. Near it were found stone axes and cut flints, clothed by time with a uniform coating of green. This discovery made a great noise, not only in France, but in England and Germany. Many learned men of the French Institute, among others, Messrs. Milne Edwards and Quatre Fages, took up the matter warmly, proved the incontestable authenticity of the bone in question, and became the ardent partisans of the maxillary process. The learned men of the United Kingdom who accepted the fact as authentic, such as Messrs. Falconer, Busk, Carpenter, etc., were supported by the German savants, and foremost among these, the warmest enthusiast, was my uncle Liddenbrock. The authenticity of a human fossil of the Fourth Epoch was thus incontestably established and admitted. Their theory, it is true, had an implacable opponent in Monsieur Elie de Beaumont. This high authority held that the formation at Moulin-Quignon did not belong to the diluvium, but to a less remote stratum, and, so far in accordance with Cuvier, he denied that the human race was contemporary with the animals of the Fourth Epoch. My uncle Liddenbrock and the great majority of geologists had maintained the opposite by discussion and controversy, and Monsieur Elie de Beaumont was left almost alone on the other side of the argument. All these details were familiar to us, but we were not aware of the progress which the question had made since our departure. Other jawbones, identical in species, though belonging to other types and nations, had been found in the light soils of certain caves in France, Switzerland, and Belgium, as well as weapons, utensils, tools, bones of children, youths, men, and aged persons. The existence of man during the Fourth Epoch was daily confirmed. And this was not all. New remains, exhumed from the tertiary Pliocene, had enabled still bolder spirits to assign an antiquity even more remote to the human species. These remains, it is true, were not actually human, but relics of man's industry, tibias and thigh bones of animals regularly striated, carved, so to speak, and which told clearly of human work. Thus, at a bound, our species gained many steps on the ladder of time. He took precedence of the mastodon. He became contemporary with the Elephas meridionalis. He dated 100,000 years back, for that is the figure assigned by the best geologists to the tertiary Pliocene. Such was the state of paleontological science, and the extent of our knowledge of it will account for our attitude as we gazed at this vast ossuary of the Sea of Liddenbrock, and also for the bewilderment of joy with which, 20 paces farther, my uncle found himself face to face with an individual man of the Fourth Epoch. It was a perfectly recognizable human body. Perhaps some peculiarity in the soil, as in St. Michael's Cemetery at Bordeaux, had thus preserved it. Who can tell? But this corpse, the skin tightened and dried like parchment, the limbs still soft to all appearance, the teeth perfect, the hair abundant, the finger and toenails of a hideous length, stood before us as in life. I was dumb before this apparition of another age. My uncle, generally so loquacious, so full of energetic talk, was silent too. We had lifted the corpse and set it upright. He looked at us from his hollow orbits. We handled his body, which sounded at our touch. After some minutes of silence, the uncle was superseded by the professor. Otto Liddenbrock, carried away by his ardent temperament, forgot the circumstances of our voyage, the place we were in, the great cavern that held us. No doubt he fancied himself in the Johannaeum, standing before his pupils, for he took the lecturer's tone, and addressing an imaginary audience said, "Gentlemen, I have the honour to introduce you to a man of the Fourth Epoch. Great savants have denied his existence. Others equally great have maintained it. The St. Thomas of paleontology, were he here, would touch him with the finger and believe. I know how necessary it is for science to be on her guard against discoveries of this kind. I am aware of the contrivances of Barnum and others of the same class to impose on the world a fossil man. I know about the kneecap of Ajax, the pretended body of Orestes, discovered by the Spartans, and the body of Asterius, 9 cubits long, of which Pausanias tells us. I have read the reports on the skeleton of Trapani, found in the 14th century, which it was sought to identify as Polyphemus, and the history of the giant disinterred near Palermo in the 16th century. You also, gentlemen, are acquainted with the analysis made near Lucerne in 1577 of those gigantic bones which the celebrated physician Felix Plater declared were those of a giant 19 feet high. I have read eagerly the treatises of Cassanio, and all the memoirs, pamphlets, essays, and counter-essays published a propos of the skeleton of the Cimbrian king Teutobochus, the invader of Gaul, exhumed in a gravel pit in Dauphiné in 1613. In the 18th century, I would have contested with Pierre Campay the existence of the pre-Adamites of Scheutzer. I have in my hands the monograph called He was my uncle's natural infirmity. He could not in public pronounce difficult words without stumbling. The monograph called He repeated. He got no further. Giganto? Nope. The unfortunate word would stick there. How they would have laughed at the Johannium. Gigantosteology! At last he brought it out between two imprecations. Then, more fluently than ever, he went on, "Yes, gentlemen, all that is familiar to me. I am aware that Cuvier and Blumenbach see in these bones simply the remains of the mammoth and other animals of the fourth epoch. But here, to doubt would be an insult to science. The body is there. You can see it. Touch it. It is no skeleton. It is a perfect form, preserved for the purposes of anthropology." I had no desire to contravene the assertion. If I could wash it in a solution of sulfuric acid, I could free it from these earthly particles and glistening shells that encrust it, but the precious solvent is wanting. But, as he is, let him tell us his story. Here the professor took the fossil corpse and handled it with the dexterity of a showman. "You see," said he, "it is not 6 feet long, far from giant proportions. As to the race it belongs to, there can be no doubt it is Caucasian, the white race, the race to which we ourselves belong. The cranium of this fossil is ovoid, without projecting cheekbones or protruding jaw. It presents no indication of prognathism, which modifies the facial angle. The facial angle is formed by two lines, one more or less vertical, which touches the forehead and the incisors, the other horizontal, passing from the auditory opening to the lower bone of the nasal sinus. The projection of the jaw, which modifies the facial angle, is called, in scientific language, prognathism. If we measure this angle, we find it almost 90 degrees, but I will go farther with my deductions. I will venture to assert that this specimen of the human race is of the family of Japheth, which extends from India to the boundary of Eastern Europe. Do not smile, gentlemen. Nobody was smiling. But the professor was used to seeing faces relax during his learned dissertations. "Yes," he continued with renewed energy, "we have here a fossil man, a contemporary of the monsters who fill this vast amphitheatre. As to how he came here, how the layers of debris in which he was embedded came into this vast cavern, I cannot offer a speculation. No one can doubt that, during the Quaternary epoch, there was considerable disturbance of the Earth's crust. The gradual cooling of the globe produces gaps, chasms, faults, into which portions of the upper strata must fall. I assert nothing, but this much is certain. Here is the man surrounded by his handiwork, these axes, these wrought flints, which mark the Stone Age. And unless he came here as a tourist like myself, a pioneer of science, I cannot entertain a doubt of his origin." The professor was silent, and I uttered my unanimous applause. My uncle was perfectly right, and wiser people than his nephew would have found it difficult to controvert his statements. Another point is that this was not the only corpse in the great bed of bones. We met with others at every few steps in the dust, and my uncle had a choice of wonderful specimens wherewith to convince unbelievers. In truth, it was an amazing sight to behold generations of men and animals in one mass of confusion in this great cemetery. But here came an important question, to which we had no solution. Were these beings already dust when, by some throw of nature, they were brought down to the shores of the Sea of Lidenbrock? Or had they lived here, in this subterranean world, with this false sky, in birth and death, like the inhabitants of the earth? Up to the present time, we had only seen sea monsters and fish alive. Were we yet to meet some man of the abyss, wandering on this lonely shore? Chapter 40. For another half hour, we wandered over these deposits of bones. We pressed on, impelled by intense curiosity. What other wonders would this cavern reveal? What new treasures for science? My eyes were on the watch for surprises, and my mind prepared for any degree of astonishment. The seashore had long been shut out by the hills formed by the ossuary. The imprudent professor, little dreaming of losing his way, drew me on to a distance. We went on, silently bathed in waves of electric light. By a phenomenon I cannot explain, the light seemed uniformly dispersed, not radiating from any center, nor casting any shade. It was as if we were in the summer noon of the equatorial region, under the vertical rays of the sun. All vapor had disappeared. The rocks, the distant mountains, confused outlines of distant forests, presented a singular aspect under the equally diffused light. We were like the fantastic creation of Hoffman, the man who lost his shadow. After walking about a mile, we found ourselves on the skirts of an immense forest, but not of a fungoid growth like those we had seen in the neighborhood of Port Gräuben. It was the vegetation of the tertiary epoch, in all its magnificence. Great palms, of a species now extinct, superb palmacites, yews, cypresses. Thujas represented the conifers, and were interlaced with an impenetrable network of lianas. The ground was thickly carpeted with mosses and hepaticas. Some small streams trickled through the groves, scarce worthy of the name as they gave no shade. At the sides of the streams grew tree ferns, like those of our hothouses. But color was wanting to trees and shrubs alike, debarred from the vivifying light of the sun. Everything was of a uniform brown, or faded tint. The leaves had no greenness, and the flowers themselves, so numerous at that epoch, now colorless and scentless, looked as if made of paper, and discolored by the action of the air. My uncle ventured into this gigantic labyrinth. I followed, not without apprehension. As nature had spread a vegetable banquet, why should we not meet with some of the terrible mammifers? In some openings left by decayed and fallen trees, I saw leguminous plants, and acers, and rubias, and a thousand other shrubs dear to the ruminants of all ages. Then, blended in one group, I beheld the trees of dissimilar climates, the oak growing beside the palm, the eucalyptus of Australia elbowing the Norwegian pine, the birch of the north mingling its branches with the kauri of New Zealand. It would puzzle the most scientific botanist of the upper earth. Suddenly I came to a stop. I held back my uncle. The diffused light made the smallest objects visible in the depths of the forest. I thought I saw... No, my eyes did not deceive me. I did see immense forms moving under the trees. They were the giant animals, a herd of mastodons, not fossil, but living, of the kind whose remains were discovered in 1801 in the swamps of the Ohio River. I distinctly saw great elephants, whose trunks were coiling among the branches like a legion of serpents. I could hear the noise of their ivory tusks as they struck the bark of the trees. The branches cracked, and the leaves, torn off in masses, disappeared down the mighty throats of these monsters. The dream, in which I seemed to see revived that prehistoric world, the third and fourth epochs, that dream was realized. My uncle looked. Come, said he, seizing my arm. Come on, we will go on. No, said I, no, we are unarmed. What could we do in the midst of a herd of giant quadrupeds? Come, uncle, come. No human creature could brave the fury of those monsters. No human creature, said my uncle in a subdued voice. You are wrong, Axel. Look down there. I think I see a human form, a being like ourselves, a man. I shrugged my shoulders while I looked and resolved not to believe it unless belief was inevitable. But in spite of myself, I was convinced. About a quarter of a mile off, leaning against the branch of an enormous kauri pine, a human being, a Proteus of these subterranean regions, a new son of Neptune, was herding that vast troop of mastodons. Immanis pecoris custos, immanior ipse. Yes, immanior ipse. It was no longer the fossil being whose corpse we had picked up on the ossuary. It was a living giant, capable of commanding these monsters. His stature was over 12 feet. His head, as large as that of a buffalo, was lost in the mass of his tangled hair. It was a mane, like that of the primeval elephant. He brandished an enormous limb of a tree, a fit crook for such a shepherd. We stood motionless, petrified. But we ran the risk of being seen. We must fly. Come, come, cried I, dragging my uncle, who for the first time in his life allowed himself to be led. A quarter of an hour after, we were out of sight of this formidable enemy. Now that I think of it all quietly, now that my mind is calm again, and that months have elapsed since that wonderful supernatural apparition, what am I to think? What am I to believe? It seems impossible. Our senses must have played us false. Our eyes did not see what they showed to us. No human creature lives in that subterranean world. No generation of men inhabits those lower caverns of the globe without an idea of the inhabitants above and without communication with them. It is madness, the height of madness. I would rather admit the existence of some animal whose structure approximates to ours, some ape of a remote geological period, some Protopithecus, some Mesopithecus, like that which Lachte discovered in the bone deposit of Sansau. But this one which we saw exceeded in size all the species known in modern paleontology, no matter. One can imagine an ape, however improbable, but a whole generation of living men shut up in the bowels of the earth. Never can I believe it. However, we left the light and luminous forest dumb with astonishment, overcome by a stupefaction which bordered on insensibility. We ran mechanically. It was a mad flight, an irresistible impulse, such as pervades some kinds of nightmare. Instinctively, we returned to the Sea of Lidenbrock, and I do not know into what vagaries my reason might have been betrayed, but that I was forcibly recalled to practical matters. Although I was certain that we were treading virgin ground, I frequently noticed groups of rock that recall to me those of Port Groyben. This was further confirmation of the indication of the compass, and of our involuntary return to the north of the Sea of Lidenbrock. It was sometimes very confusing. Hundreds of rills and cascades fell from the crags. I seemed to recognize the stratum of Surtjebrand, our faithful Hansbach, and the grotto where I first regained my senses. Then again, at a little distance lay the rocky sea wall, the appearance of a streamlet, the striking outline of a rock, threw me into a state of indecision as to our whereabouts. I imparted my doubts to my uncle. He, too, was in a maze. In a panorama so vast and so monotonous, there was nothing the mind could fix on as a landmark. "At any rate," said I, "we have not landed at our point of embarkation. The storm has led us lower down, and if we follow the shore, we shall come to Port Groyben." "If that is so," said my uncle, "we need explore no further. The best thing we can do is to get back to the raft. But are you sure you are correct, Axel?"
"It is difficult to say positively, Uncle. All the rocks are alike. And yet I fancy I recognize the promontory at whose foot Hans put our raft together. We ought to be near the little port. Unless, indeed, this is it," added I, scrutinizing the small creek.
"No, Axel, if that was so, we should find our own tracks, and I see nothing of the kind."
"But I see," said I, darting toward something that shone on the sand.
"What is it?"
"Look," said I, and I showed my uncle the dagger stained with rust which I had picked up.
"Steady now," said he. "Did you bring this weapon with you?"
"I? No, indeed. But you?"
"Not to my knowledge," replied the professor. "I never had such a thing in my possession."
"How strange."
"Well, no. After all, it is simple enough, Axel. The Icelanders often have poniards of this kind. Hans must have dropped this one. No doubt it is his."
I shook my head. Hans had never had anything of the kind.
"Is it the weapon," cried I, "of some antediluvian warrior? Of a living man? A contemporary of the giant herdsman? But no, it does not belong to the Stone Age, nor to the Age of Bronze, either. This blade is steel."
My uncle stopped me short in this new digression, and in his coldest tone he said,
"Calm yourself, Axel, and collect your wits. This poniard is a weapon of the 16th century, a true dagger, such as noblemen used to carry in their belt to give the coup de grace. It belongs neither to you, nor me, nor the hunter, nor even to the human beings who may live in the bowels of the earth."
"Would you venture to say—"
"See, that notch never came from cutting throats. The blade is covered with rust that dates not from a day, nor a year, nor an age."
The professor grew warm, as usual, when he gave the reins to his imagination.
"Axel," said he, "we are on the road to the great discovery. This blade has lain on the sand 100, 200, perhaps 300 years, and that notch was made by the rocks of this subterranean sea."
"But," said I, "it did not come here by itself. It did not give itself this twist. Someone has been here before us."
"Yes, a man.
And this man has graven his name with this dagger. He wanted to mark once more the road to the central point. Let us search everywhere." Intensely interested, we kept close along the high wall, prying into the narrowest crevices that looked like the entrance to a gallery. At last, we came to a place where the shore narrowed.
The sea almost washed the foot of the cliff, leaving a passage not more than 6 feet wide. Between two projecting points of rock, we saw the entrance to a dark tunnel. There, on a block of granite, stood the mysterious letters, half effaced, the initials of the bold traveller.
A.S., cried my uncle. Arne Sagnusum, always Arne Sagnusum.
Chapter 41. Since the commencement of our travels, I had passed through so many phases of wonder and surprise that I thought nothing could startle me any more, or excite a feeling of astonishment. But when I beheld these two letters, cut 300 years ago, I stood there in a state of bewilderment akin to idiocy. Not only was the signature of the great alchemist before my eyes, but his stylet was in my hands. It would be an unbeliever indeed who could doubt the existence of the traveller and the reality of his travels. While these thoughts were racking my brain, the professor went off into dithyrambics on Arne Sagnusum.
"Wonderful genius!" cried he. "You neglected nothing that could open to other mortals the channels through the earth's crust, and your fellow men can follow your traces after 3 centuries in the depths of these dark caves. You have done everything to enable others to behold these marvels. Your name, engraved from stage to stage, is an unfailing guide to anyone bold enough to tread in your footsteps, and I believe your autograph will be found at the center of our planet. Well, I too will write my name on this last page of granite, but henceforth this cape, discovered by you near this sea, shall be called Cape Sagnusum."
That is the substance of what I heard, and my own enthusiasm was rising with his words. A fire seemed to burn in my breast. I forgot everything, the dangers of the voyage and the perils of the return. What another had done, I would dare, and nothing appeared to me impossible.
"Forward, forward!" I exclaimed.
As I spoke, I sprang forward toward the dark gallery, when the professor, usually so prone to hasty action, restrained me, and advised coolness and patience.
"First, let us go back to Hans," said he, "and bring the raft round to this point."
I obeyed with a bad grace, and hastened to the beach.
"Uncle," said I, "do you know that circumstances have been very much in our favour up to now?"
"Do you think so, Axel?"
"I do. Why, everything, even the storm, combined to set us in the right track. Blessings on the hurricane. It landed us on the very coast from which fine weather would have carried us far away. Just fancy if our prow, a raft with a prow, had touched the southern shore of the Liddenbrock Sea, what would have become of us? The name of Sagnusum would never have greeted our eyes. We should be wandering on a shore without an outlet."
"Yes, Axel, there is really some providential guidance which brought us, going to the south, back to the north, and to Cape Sagnusum. I must say it is more than astonishing, and there is something in it that baffles my sagacity to explain."
"What does it matter?" said I. "We do not need to account for facts, only to make the most of them."
"Certainly, my boy, but we are going northward again. We shall pass under the northernmost countries in Europe, Sweden, Russia, Siberia, who knows? Instead of penetrating under the deserts of Africa or the waves of the ocean."
"And what more do I want to know?"
"Yes, Axel, you are right, and it is all for the best, as we shall leave this horizontal sea, which can lead nowhere. We shall go down, down, always down. Do you know that before we reach the centre, we have only 4,500 miles to travel?"
"Bah," said I, "that is not worth mentioning. Let us start at once."
We talked on in this mad tone till we returned to the hunter. Everything was ready for an immediate start. Every package was on board. We took our stations on the raft, and the sail being hoisted, Hunt steered for Cape Saknussemm, following the coastline. The wind was not very favourable to a craft that could not sail very close. In some places we had to resort to poles to assist our progress. Often low, submerged rocks compelled us to go far out of our course. At last, after about 3 hours of navigation, that is, about 6 o'clock in the evening, we reached a point that offered a good landing place. I leaped on shore, followed by my uncle and the Icelander. The short passage had not calmed my spirits. On the contrary, I proposed burning our ship to cut off all temptation to retreat. My uncle would not